Speaking on this program is Chris Perry.
I know of a couple who grew up associated with the church. They attended services as they were growing up. They married and postponed their faithfulness for several years, maybe even decades. And by the time I came along and met them, they were faithful members. Church was a big part of their lives. And I remember in casual conversation one day, they said this: the subject of the dinosaurs was one of the subjects that tripped us up for the longest and postponed our faithfulness, because we never really understood how they fit into a biblical perspective of creation, a biblical perspective of what happened after that, their relationship to man and all of those things. And every time I think about this topic, I think about that, because I bet there are thousands of people just like them who haven't ever really fully studied this idea of the dinosaurs and how they fit into the biblical record. And we're inundated with dinosaurs everywhere we go. My kids watch PBS some, and they watch Disney and Nickelodeon, and nearly every one of those channels has a show that depicts dinosaurs in some shape, form, or fashion. And we have to be very careful, because quite often they depict them in the way that you always hear: millions of years ago, in this era, in that era, you know, dinosaurs did this and that. And my son and daughter, my youngest son is too small, but Jordan especially, he says, "Now, Daddy, I know that's not right. Man, look at that dinosaur. Isn't he awesome?" And so he appreciates what the shows depict about the dinosaurs, but understands that it's in a biblical context that he needs to understand it. Well, there are probably a lot of us who have a lot of questions about it. I know that there was a time in my life when I had a ton of questions about dinosaurs and their relationship to what the Bible teaches concerning creation and the flood and all those things. That's kind of what we're going to talk about tonight. I welcome your comments. I don't know, I didn't ask. I guess we can have, you know, it's like a Bible class type setting. That's how I try to do it at Hebron. And so if you have a comment, if you have a question, I'd love to hear it. I think a Bible class setting is probably the best setting to talk about things like this, because, you know, I have questions. And if you do, I welcome them as we go through. So, what about the dinosaurs? Now, we're going to start out with the evolutionary view of it. When did the dinosaurs live is going to be our first question. Then we're going to talk a little bit about when they really lived, and then what killed them according to evolution, then what really killed them. And we're going to try to balance those things out. Look at Wikipedia. And I chose Wikipedia because everybody has access to that. If I asked you to, you could pull out your phones, and in 10 seconds, you could come up with exactly what I've got here. According to Wikipedia, dinosaurs first appeared during the Triassic period, approximately 230 million years ago, and became the dominant terrestrial vertebrates for 135 million years, from the beginning of the Jurassic, which is about 200 million years ago, until the end of the Cretaceous period, which is about 65.5 million years ago. So, we have dinosaurs and their existence framed in a span of millions of years, in an evolutionary time frame that modern science places upon the history of the world. And that is what you'll get in textbooks. That's what you'll get in high school, elementary, middle, college classes for the most part. And that's what you get in popular culture. How do they come up with that date? You see, if we're going to talk about dinosaurs and how they fit into to creation and how they fit into the creation of the world, we need to know how evolutionists come to these dates. They use two methods. The first is radiometric dating. Raise your hand if you've ever heard of carbon dating or radiometric dating. I mean, that's the popular method of dating things. And to hear scientists tell it, radiometric dating is the end-all be-all of finding the date for something. It is as accurate a method as anything in the world could be. I found this, and I don't want anybody to think that some of the things I put up here came from me. I'm not smart enough to come up with a lot of these things myself. So I borrowed. This is from answeringgenesis.org. You can find tons of helps. Apologetics Press has wonderful stuff in their website about creation versus evolution. If you're a fan of Think Magazine, you know, a lot of those publications have a lot of good information. So you can find these things just about anywhere. Here's the layman's explanation of radiometric dating. What they do is they base it on the assumption that every bit of matter has a certain amount of uranium in it. Over time, it decays. And it decays according to their theories at a very regular rate, a measurable rate. And so what you can do, according to the idea, is you can measure how much of that uranium has turned into lead, and you therefore have a good measuring stick as to how old that piece of matter is. Very simply, that's what you do. The uranium, the U up there, would be the parent matter, the parent atom. It, over time, becomes, decays into lead, which are the daughter atoms. Okay? So that's what you have up there. You have the parent atoms and the daughter atoms. So over time, they go from uranium to lead. Over time, that's supposedly what happens. That's based on three assumptions. And I know this is getting very scientific, and you say, what about the Bible? We'll get into that in just a minute. Assumption number one says that the original number of unstable atoms can be known. In order to use radiometric dating, you have to say, I know how many uranium atoms this piece of matter started with. Okay? Let's do it like a loaf of bread. We went to West Tennessee this last week, and we bought bread and brought it with us. We came back, and there was bread already at the house that we had bought earlier. And then Danielle's granny brought us bread. So we had three loaves of bread at the house. Danielle made French toast. And if you have a family of five, French toast can just about wipe out a loaf of bread. So I've got bread on the brain. So think about a loaf of bread. Let's say that you buy groceries on Monday, and in a given week, your family goes through a whole loaf of bread in a week, and the next Monday when you go to the grocery store, you buy another loaf of bread. If it works the way it's supposed to, on Thursday, how much bread should you have? Anybody? Yeah, I didn't know we were going to have to do math. Roughly. Okay, but let's say it's at a regular rate. 37. I was going to say half. Of course, you're roughly half, right? Okay, you know, you've got Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, and then you've got Friday, Saturday, Sunday. So Thursday is the halfway point, right? So if you went halfway through the day on Thursday, theoretically, right, you should have half a loaf of bread left. Now, is that how it works? Are there variables that determine how much bread you're going to have? We hosted, last year we had a gospel meeting speaker come in who had five daughters. They stayed at our home. We have three children. So there's our five plus their seven. Did bread decay at the same rate as it would have before? No. There were more mouths to eat it, correct? So the variables, the outside variables changed. In order to use radiometric dating, you have to assume no variables change. Okay, you have to assume you fully understand how much uranium you started with. What if you had a loaf and a half of bread to start the week with? Are you still going to have a half loaf left on Thursday? No, because you started out with more. But in order to use radiometric dating, you have to base it on the assumption that you always start out with a regular number of uranium atoms. That's the first assumption. Number two, you have to assume that the rate of change was constant. That the rate of change never fluctuated. You didn't have more mouths eating the bread. You didn't make an extra sandwich for lunch because, hey, you were just hungrier that day than you were. Our children, there was a time when you cut a sandwich in half, you give one half to Jordan, one half to Sydney, and you were done. And then it somehow got to this point where you cut one sandwich in half and you give it all to Jordan. And then you give Sydney a half a sandwich. And then you have an extra half a sandwich that you can eat yourself. Now it's gotten to where Jordan has a sandwich, Sydney has a sandwich, Jordan wants another sandwich, Sydney wants a half a sandwich, and Bennett's eating a sandwich. So you see, the rate of consumption has changed. Outside variables are dependent. Number three, you have to assume that the daughter atoms were all produced by radioactive decay. There was no groundwater that came in and changed the rate. There were no outside forces that had anything to do with radiometric dating. Those three assumptions. Now, what I'd like to do is go back and notice these three assumptions. Number one, this idea that you always know how many unstable atoms you started with. The problem with that is what biblical scholars call a parent age. What is a parent age? Okay? Okay. That's not exactly what we're talking about. We're going to get to a timeline here in just a minute. I think I know what you've got in mind. And when it comes to Bible, what is apparent age? Anybody heard that before? When Adam was created, in what stage was he created? He's a grown man. Okay, he certainly was. I've actually never thought of that. I just learned something. That's why I have people comment, because I learn. Yeah, that's right. He could obviously communicate and speak and those types of things. That's certainly true. And he can name the animals. That's right. And he can name the woman that came after him. So you've got Adam and Eve who were created not as infants like we would. We think of when something comes into the world, it comes in, newborn, and then that being grows and develops. Adam and Eve were created with a parent age. They were created, were they 30 years old? Well, yes and no. From a maturity standpoint, they could have been 18, 19, 20, whatever age was the mature age. But from a chronological standpoint, how old were they? They were infants. So you see, that's a parent age. Go to Genesis chapter 2 and you'll see another example of that from the physical world. A parent age is a very important principle to understand when it comes to creation. In Genesis chapter 2, we're going to start in verse number 10. Genesis, of course, this is kind of a second perspective of the creation. Genesis chapter 1, you have the 6 days of creation and you're rested. In Genesis chapter 2, it's as if the camera zeroes in on some more specific aspects of that creation. In Genesis chapter 2, begin in verse 10. And a river went out of Eden to water the garden, and from thence it was parted and became into four heads. You've got Pison, you've got Gihon there, you've got Hiddekel, and then you've got the Euphrates in verses 14 there and on. Now, here's the point I want to make. Did those rivers have water in them? What? It wouldn't be a river without water. And what did it say they did? They watered the garden. So they had to have water in them. There are two problems with that. Number one, they were just created. How long does it take for a dry riverbed to fill up? Depends on how much rain they get. Oh, that's problem number two. How much rain had fallen in the world? None. So, God created rivers with water already in them, didn't He? God created Adam and Eve already mature to the point that they could conceive and bear children. What was created first, light or the sun, moon, and stars that give light? Light. How long does it take for the light from stars to reach Earth? A long time. Millions of years. You know, that's something that evolutionists have leveled at the Bible account of creation, right? There's no way that the Earth can only be thousands of years old because we already see light from the stars. And if the universe was only thousands of years old, we still wouldn't be seeing any light from the stars yet. Oh, what about apparent age? Apparent age says that God created the stars and the light already coming to Earth from those stars. Just as He created Adam and Eve at 30 years old or 19 years old, childbearing age. Just like He created rivers that already had water in them. Just like, and this comes to our point about radiometric dating, just like He created rocks that were already in the process of radioactive decay. So what you see when Adam and Eve are created and the earth is created, you see a rock that already appears to be millions of years old. That's how God created it. It's as if God created everything midstream. He didn't create it from the ground up and let it just develop in the process that evolution would account for. God created it midstream. Fully grown people. Fully grown and developed animals. Rivers with water in them. Stars with light already coming to Earth. Because if He didn't do that, we'd be waiting around twiddling our thumbs for millions of years until light finally got here. Until water finally filled up in the rivers. Until these things finally happened. God created the world with apparent age. So the problem then with radiometric dating is how much uranium had already been decayed when those rocks were created. That's problem number one. Problem number two, with assumption number two, is that the rate of change was constant. Go to 2 Peter chapter 3. You know, Solomon says there's nothing new under the sun. And he's right. Of course he's right, because he was the wisest man, mortal man, ever to live, save for Jesus Christ, but he was at the same time the dumbest man ever to live, because he didn't listen to his own wisdom. But in 2 Peter chapter 3, begin with me in verse number 3. And this is a common problem that people today have as well. Knowing this first, Peter says, that there shall come in the last days scoffers, walking after their own lusts, and saying, notice what they say, where is the promise of His coming? For since the fathers fell asleep, all things continue as they were from the beginning of creation. What is their mistake? What do they believe about the world? It's always been the way it is now. In order to believe, in order to assume radiometric dating is always accurate, you have to believe that all criteria by which radiometric dating works are the same as they were back then. The problem is, that's not true. And notice verse 5. He mentions one specific event. Verse 5, for this they willingly are ignorant of, that by the word of God the heavens were of old, and the earth standing out of water and in the water, whereby the world that then was being overflowed with water perished. What event is he referencing? The flood. The flood created catastrophic change. Geographic change. Atmospheric change. It created all sorts of radioactive change, and we'll talk some about that in just a little bit. You have to take into account a catastrophic event like the flood, which would have changed the rates at which everything decayed. It would have changed the rates in which all of these things happened. In order to accept radiometric dating as the end-all be-all for telling how old something is, you have to assume that no catastrophic event ever happened. You know the problem with evolution? Even they acknowledge catastrophic events have happened. You know what they claim wiped out the dinosaurs? We'll talk about that in a little bit. Some huge meteor that struck Mexico. A catastrophic event would have affected the rate of decay of the very minerals and materials that you're trying to gauge in terms of their age. So you can't have any catastrophic events. You can't have anything that was created with apparent age. And number 3, in order to use radiometric dating as an end-all be-all, you have to assume that no outside forces took place. And that is just simply bad science. Bad science. Why do they want to assume all of these things? If you're an evolutionary biologist, how do you make your money? Grants. If you come out and say, you know, evolution, I don't know that it's true or that it isn't, but I'm kind of skeptical. What's going to happen to those grants? Dry up. It's going to dry up immediately. I don't know if you've ever seen the documentary Expelled. It's an interesting documentary. It has Ben Stein. Ben Stein, the boring guy off of Ferris Bueller's Day Off. I think he was an economics teacher in Ferris Bueller's Day Off. He hosted some game shows in the 1990s. He is a Jew, but he's also a believer in intelligent design. What he did is he went around to evolutionary biologists and he asked them questions about creation. It's amazing how confrontational those people became. It's also very interesting how creation scientists were treated in the scientific community. They were ostracized. They were cut off. Science, what does science mean? Knowledge, omniscience. That's all knowing. It's the search for knowledge. In order to seek knowledge, the number one quality you need is objectivity. Are evolutionary scientists subjective? No. Because they are married to their theory. The same accusation they level at creationists is true of them. They have faith in evolution. And so they're going to find it. They come in with certain assumptions. These three assumptions don't necessarily have to be true. And so that's radiometric dating. I hope you're all still following me and aren't dead asleep. Number 2. Another method they use to measure, you mentioned a timeline, Brandy. They use what's called the geological timetable. And the geological timetable is a system of chronological measurements that relates stratigraphy with time. You say, I don't understand what that means. You're with me, so I have a diagram. And again, this is not something I designed either. But up here you have evolution's and geology's view of the timeline. It's already... You said 7. Oh, Man, don't scare me like that. Oh. Do what? 20 minutes. If I ask again, will it be 25? All right. So here you have geology's version of the timeline. What they've done is they've taken strata in the ground, that is the sediments as they have collected, create strata. If you've gone to the Grand Canyon, if you've gone to any place that has massive rock structures, you see strata, don't you? Lines where sediment has settled in various sections. Here's what they do. They say, in the Cretaceous section there, you've got fossil X. Well, fossil X is 65 million years old. So that means that everything else in that Cretaceous period is how old? 65 million years. They use that fossil, which they claim to know the age of, as a marker for all the other fossils they find. Okay? Here's how one individual described it. The dating of the rocks depends on the evolutionary sequence of the fossils. So if you see a rock next to a 65 million year old fossil, if they're in the same strata, you say they're the same age, right? That makes good nonsense. I mean, it makes sense. You can see how they would come up with that. But how do they know how old the fossil is? By the rock. How do they know how old the rock is? By the fossil. And radiometric dating will come in here too. But what it becomes is circular reasoning. You ever had somebody say, I don't like that person? Why not? Because they're mean. Why do you think they're mean? Because I don't like them. If you talk to kids very often, they'll say the same thing. I don't like that person. Why? Because they're mean. Why are they mean? Because I don't like them. You notice how those two things are dependent upon each other, but neither one of them has a leg to stand on. That's called a circular argument, circular reasoning. Notice what it is. The dating of the rocks depends on the evolutionary sequence of the fossils, but the evolutionary interpretation of the fossils depends on the dating of the rocks. No wonder the evolutionary system to outsiders implies circular reasoning. You know who said that? An evolutionary scientist. That's not a creationist saying that. An evolutionary scientist said the rocks are dependent on the fossils and the fossils are dependent on the rocks. Let's go back to our timetable. They define these things based on what they find, but here's some very interesting points to consider. I sat in a geology class at UT Martin in 19-something. And I still want you to think of me as a young preacher. I was introduced Sunday night. I spoke at Bobby Branch, and he said, he's not so young anymore. I won't have any of that business. I'm a young preacher. But anyway, one of the things that he mentioned, this geology professor mentioned, was sometimes things from the Jurassic period are found way up in the Holocene layer. And sometimes things from the Holocene period are found way down in the Cretaceous layer. And sometimes the entire strata is reversed. Whew. And geologists say, how in the world did that happen? Do you know they have no clear-cut answers as to why that happens? How something that's supposed to be tens of millions of years older than what's above it can be above it. How that can happen, they can't explain it. And those anomalies, yes, sir. Yes, that, and I forget the name for them, of course you're going to put me on the spot. But yes, that there are, in fact, large femur bones of large animals that are found going between three or four strata. And so they go in between what would be millions of years worth of a span of time. I didn't really intend to get into this, but you know what the best explanation for strata is in all of science? The flood. The flood. If you've ever done anything with water, if you've ever played, kids today are missing out if they've not gone in an actual creek and splashed around in the water. Do what? Amen. When you splash around in the water, that sediment comes up, right? Especially if you're in fairly deep water and you can see the sediment flying around you. But then if you stand still long enough, what happens? It settles. And things settle based on what? How quickly do they settle? What determines that? Weight. Okay, volume, or, you know, we get into things that I studied in high school, but that's been way too long ago. That bell needs to stop. It's bothering me. No, that's okay. the flood would explain why we have strata. As a massive amount of water comes through, things that were heavier would settle at a different rate than things that were lighter. Things that were more dense would settle at a different rate than things that were less dense. And thus you would have organized strata as everything fell back into place. And that's a much better explanation. Why then would you have things that were completely flip-flopped? Because you've got a mass of water running into the side of a mountain, breaking it in half and flipping it over. And thus you would have something completely turned up on its head right next to something that was right side up. That's a much better explanation, but not one that people are willing to accept. So, what we've just seen is that the two methods of dating have serious problems with them. And there are so many other things that along these lines. I remember when I was in elementary school, we would go to caves. My parents loved to cave. Not spelunking, you know, where we would actually, you know, but actually walking through caves that had become commercialized. And you would see stalactites and stalagmites. Which is which? Okay, stalactites are hanging. I'll take your word for it. Stalagmites then come up from the ground. And they would say, it takes millions of years for these to form. Don't touch them. And then maybe you've seen, and these are bona fide pictures and people have found them, people have gone down into the basements that are very moist and wet. And what do they find? Stalactites and stalagmites growing in their basement. Those basements have not been there for millions of years. You might have some very old basements. You know what changed? The climate, the environment in that basement accelerated the process. That's exactly what we're talking about. You have to take environment into account. So now, we've said all of that. I hope that's as clear as mud to you all. I hope I've just cleared up all your misconceptions. I know I haven't. If you have any questions, please stop me. So, what we're going to do then is say, when did the dinosaurs really live? And then we've got a whole other point to go through, so we'll have to step it up a little bit. When did the dinosaurs really live? Well, 2 points. Number one, if you accept the Bible account of creation, which you should and you must, and we don't have reason to get into all the reasons why you should and must, but if you accept the biblical account of creation, you have to understand that the dinosaurs were created during the 6 days of creation. Genesis 1 and verse 20, God said, let the waters bring forth abundantly moving creatures that have life, and the fowl that may fly above the earth in the open firmament of heaven. Let the earth bring forth the living creature after his kind, cattle, creeping thing, beast of the earth after his kind. And it was so. Every animal that could be created was created on that day. But you say, preacher, I don't believe that. I believe the Bible, but I think there's something else at work. In the book of Exodus chapter 20, which we know contains the Ten Commandments, God is instituting the law of the Sabbath. How long were people to recognize the Sabbath? For how long a period of time? In terms of days. 1 day, right? 24 hours, okay? So 1 day in Exodus 20 is 24 hours, right? Okay. Exodus 20 and verse 11, for in 6 days the Lord made, and what did He make? Heaven, earth, sea, and all that in them is. Was there anything according to the Bible record that was not created on those 6 days of creation? Not according to the Bible record. You cannot believe both evolution and the Bible. Well, people say, well, those days represent millions of years. If so, then the Sabbath lasts millions of years because that's the word He was using, days. We rest for 1 day. In Genesis 1, the morning and the evening were the first day. The morning and the evening. Look it up. It's in Genesis 1. And the evening were the second day. Everything that was created in those 6 days. You can't have it both ways. So they were created during the 6 days of creation. And then, just go ahead and label me the dumbest man on the face of the earth, because any science teacher worth his or her salt would say, you're an idiot for saying that humans and dinosaurs coexisted. Well, they had to, according to the biblical account of creation, didn't they? Because they were created at the same time. But, even further proof. We don't have time to get into Job chapter 40 and 41, but in Job chapter 40, you've got a behemoth described. The King James Version uses the word behemoth. Now, many have tried to say, well, that's actually a hippopotamus. Let me run through the qualifications, the characteristics of this behemoth. He moves his tail like a cedar. He's the chief of the ways of God, and he that made him can make his sword to approach him. You have to be armed to fight him. Hippopotamus tails do not meet the qualifications you see in Job chapter 40. They are not near as fierce as what you see. And we're having to run through this quickly. That sounds much more like a dinosaur-like creature than it does a hippo. But why do people try to say it's a hippo? Because men and dinosaurs didn't coexist. Okay? But here's one that's even clearer. Job chapter 41. Leviathan. And if we had music from movies, dun dun dun, the Leviathan is a massive creature. A scary creature. Notice the qualifications, the characteristics of the Leviathan. He is unapproachable. You cannot approach this individual, this being. He has a flame that goes out of his mouth. Job 41, 18 through 21. He raises up himself. He can sit on his hind legs. Okay? And thus the mighty are afraid. His underside is sharp stones or scales. Now, people have translated this in modern translations, a crocodile. Have you ever seen a fire-breathing crocodile that can stand on its hind legs? I never have. Job 41 does not describe a crocodile. It describes a dinosaur-like creature. By the way, if you're looking for things that match up to the behemoth and the leviathan, what used to be called the brontosaurus is almost exactly what you see in the behemoth. Did you know the behemoth of chapter 40 is a vegetarian? It stretches its head to eat. Remember the brontosaurus you saw as you were, when you were a child in cartoons and books? Fits it perfectly. And how about the Tyrannosaurus Rex that we've all heard about? Fits very well with what you see in Job 41. By the way, and this is free of charge, you can take it or leave it. Nearly every culture has a dragon myth. A dragon myth. You know, we've all heard about them, right? Those mythological creatures that could breathe fire and could fly, that looked like massive dinosaurs? Is it possible that that kind of being is what Job saw? What would explain why so many cultures have a dragon myth? And by the way, number two, and this doesn't have to be true, what about Loch Ness? We'll talk about that in just a minute. We've got to move on. Humans and dinosaurs live together. But you say there's no proof in science that that's the case. Grand Canyon. Look what Native Americans drew in the Grand Canyon. Long before they knew anything about fossils. This is called the water panther. That's the translation from the Native American tongue, the water panther. Okay? A Native American scholar traveled, he said, from Canada to Mexico interviewing Native American oral traditionists, the historians of the Native Americans. Every single Native American culture had a monster myth of dinosaur-like creatures. Every single one, from Canada to Mexico. All over the world, you see these things. That's in the Grand Canyon. That is in Utah. Look what it resembles. This is in Peru. Pottery. What does that look like to you? Triceratops. This is in Mexico. The next one is in Utah. All over the world you see artifacts depicting these monster-like creatures. My question is, did they have the Discovery Channel? How did they know that these things existed? What is the only way a Native American could have depicted something like this? They had to have seen one in person or know somebody who did. That's the only explanation for why worldwide you find depictions of dinosaur-like creatures. All over the world you find them. And people have tried to debunk some of them. There are so many of them, you can't debunk them all. These are actual dated artifacts that archaeologists and historians understand are real. Dinosaurs and humans lived together. But people will say, it's just not possible. Dinosaurs and humans couldn't live together because they'd kill us. Anybody ever been to the circus? Can we train elephants? Have you ever seen somebody ride a whale? Could those animals crush us in a moment? What did God say concerning man? Gave him dominion. We can tame just about every creature. Number two, How did they get in the ark for the flood? Did God have to put fully grown animals in the ark? No. And by the way, even evolutionary scientists understand this. Were most dinosaurs the size of Tyrannosaurus Rex? Most dinosaurs were small creatures, relatively small creatures. That could have easily fit in the ark. And if they couldn't, you take the small ones. You could have had an egg. There's options here, fellas. And we have no animals similar to that today. If they were alive then, why aren't they alive now? Well, do you know the bombardier beetle can breathe fire? We have no fire-breathing animals today, they say. Bombardier beetle has two chemicals in its backside. When it combines them, it's fire. It's a defense mechanism. It can happen. But now, here's what we've got to do in close. What killed the dinosaurs? According to evolution, the theories go all over the place because they just don't know. Here are some options. Number one, a giant meteor impacted Mexico, created what I see as a nuclear fallout. Dust and sediment was sent into the atmosphere, and it created this darkness over the face of the earth, and animals that couldn't hack it died out. That's number one option. Meteor hit Mexico, created a catastrophic disaster worldwide. Okay? Number two, a species of rat ate all their eggs. Okay, maybe. Number three, a disease that pinpointed them, and only them, maybe a dinosaur epidemic of some sort. Maybe every other animal washed their hands properly, but the dinosaurs. I'm just teasing. Number four, and this is an actual, you think I'm making fun, this is an actual theory. Maybe dinosaurs were just too stupid to survive, and so they all died out. Or maybe they were just too apathetic. You know, I'm pretty comfortable. I know there's a catastrophic disaster. I'm just going to sit here. That's what some scientists have theorized. What are some better options biblically? Number one, the effects of the flood. First of all, the catastrophic waters would have done a number on a lot of animals. Okay? God saved animals. Did He save all of them? Did some? I don't know. But He saved animals. But there were going to be a whole lot of animals. And even the ones that were saved were thinned out severely. Okay? You just have a sampling of all of those animals living. And so, of course, when they begin to repopulate, some of them aren't going to repopulate as well as others. But think about this, and I wish I had a diagram, and we're almost out of time. In Genesis chapter 1, I'd like you to go there this evening with me. And I wish I had time to talk about this a little bit more. There was what scientists have termed a water canopy over the earth. Go to Genesis chapter 1, in verse number 6 and 7. And God said, "Let there be a firmament in the midst of the waters, and let it divide the waters from the waters." And God made the firmament and divided the waters which were under the firmament from the waters which were above the firmament. From that, we get the idea that there was quite possibly and probably a canopy of vapor, water vapor, that encapsulated the earth. And you say, where in the world do you get that? Water above the firmament, water below the firmament. Water below the firmament would be seas, lakes, such and such. Above the firmament, there was water too. What was that? It's not there anymore. What was it? When God caused the flood in Genesis 6, 7, and 8, guess what it's described as? The windows of heaven were opened. It's as if God took a pen and popped the water canopy. And all of that water came crashing down. Now here's what's interesting about this. If there was a water canopy encapsulating the earth, it would have done a good job of filtering out ultraviolet rays. What is ultraviolet rays? What are their main purpose? What do they do to us? They cause us to age. It would have also changed barometric pressure. Things can grow larger in different amounts of barometric pressure. If the barometric pressure drastically changed, guess what also changed? The ability of animals to grow large. They can't take in as much oxygen at one breath. They can't grow as large. It's interesting, right after the flood, what started happening to the average age of man? Going down. You don't have that water canopy filtering out ultraviolet rays. People could intermarry before the flood, After the flood, gradually that started being less and less. Why? Because the genetic pool wasn't nearly as pure as it was before. Because ultraviolet rays also caused mutations in the genetic pool. Makes a whole lot of sense. A whole lot more sense than rats that ate all their eggs or a bunch of lazy dinosaurs. There are biblical options that make good sense. Number two, the effects of cohabiting with man. Could man have hunted down all the dinosaurs? Could they have killed them? They certainly could have. What happened to the buffalo that used to roam this fair land? That's exactly what happened. And it could have been very well that caused the demise of the dinosaurs. Now, I'll give you this, and I know we're out of time. Think about places like Loch Ness. Water extremely deep. I think that's the deepest loch in that region, where the barometric pressure, the environment, and climate could be such that some of those animals could still maintain their large size. It's a possibility. Now, I'm not a Loch Ness monster fanatic. I don't know if it's real or not. I'm just throwing that out there for you. Now, last thing I want to talk about, and then this will be yours. Lessons we learned from this discussion. Number one, science is not always truth. Let's skip down to that second one, that second scripture there. 1 Thessalonians 5:21, prove all things. Hold fast that which is good. Examine your alternatives to what you read and see in popular culture. Number two, man is God's crowning creation. Dinosaurs weren't the beasts that ruled the earth. God created man as the crown of His creation. And number three, the bigger they are, the harder they fall. It's true with the dinosaurs. It's true with Goliath. And it can be true with us. You've been good, group. I appreciate your time and attention. You probably have more questions than you have answers. But I appreciate your attention tonight. Thank you.